Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. So glad to have you with us this week. Coming up on this week's show, we'll talk a little Bed Bath & Beyond, as we previewed last week. They had an earnings call this past Thursday, so we'll talk about that. We'll also talk a little bit about Walmart's proposed new Supercenter format that they're looking to bring to 1,000 locations over the next couple of years. Our interview guest is T. Jacob Smoody. He is the produce manager at the Bisman Community Food Co-op in Bismarck, North Dakota. This is actually a retailer I visited on my trip through the Dakotas and Montana about a month ago, and I was very, very impressed with this store. Unique concept, the food co-op. You see it from market to market sometimes, but he'll join us to discuss not only the unique concept overall, but also his mission to bring fresh produce to the folks of Bismarck and also some of their partnerships with local farmers. So in that way, it kind of ties in with last week's interview with Sarah Fisher that we had. So stay tuned for that. It's a great interview, and T. Jacob is someone very, very passionate about the retail industry. A reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, you name it. You can rate us there if you enjoy the podcast. It helps other people find us out. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast, both Instagram and Twitter. So let's dive into it. Much anticipated earnings call for Bed Bath & Beyond this past week, and they did not disappoint with their first same-store sales gain since the fourth quarter of 2016. This came despite online sales only increasing. I say only, bit of an asterisk there, 89% year over year. We honestly felt that they had much more runway for growth in that channel, but still 89%. A substantial number. And as we noted, this earnings call comes after announcements of company cuts in late August, looking to cut a number of positions throughout the company, and a recent C-suite hiring spree over the last couple of months for the new CEO, Mark Tritton. So let's begin with the numbers. As we mentioned at the top, comp sales were up, but not by a slim margin. They popped over last year's second quarter by 6%, coming after comp sales were down 7%. In last year's second quarter. However, this did come on reduced net sales. The number of stores in their system declined due to store closures and kicking also One Kings Lane to the curb. Finally, cut down on their net sales somewhat, which were down about 1% for the quarter as a whole. But by the way, if you look month over month from last year, July and August net sales were both up over 1 year ago. So that's a positive sign for the retailer. Comp sales did include that 89% digital sales increase, so their comp sales include digital sales. Their in-store sales, their brick-and-mortar sales, as could be expected, were down about 12%. And as we mentioned last week, they've been fairly cautious about reopening stores, so we expected a bit of a brick-and-mortar drop-off for some time now. That said, the one thing we found interesting is that buy online, pickup in-store only accounted for about 15% of their overall digital sales in the quarter. Now, this is triple the previous year's number, but it's still a long way to go from the 60 to 70% that we see other retailers boast of, whether it be in the home improvement sector, whether it be in the clothing sector. JCPenney, a department store, for example, they see a lot of their orders touching those physical stores. Something that the company was very big on, Bed Bath & Beyond, that is, was that the adjusted gross margin was up this quarter around 200 basis points to 35.9%. Now, for this, they credited a favorable product mix, more on this in a moment, additionally lower coupon expense. This is something that they had been attempting to do now for a few months, really several months. You might have noticed fewer of those 20% off coupons showing up in your mailbox of late. Finally, they credited better optimization of markdowns, basically being judicious about the markdown amount and not marking down as much as in the prior year's second quarter. A small dent in these gains, though, did result from increased direct-to-consumer costs. We talked about the e-commerce. We talked about the fact that most of it is direct to the consumer. It's not touching those physical stores. As such, shipping expense begins to creep in, and we should expect shipping expense to be a hurdle for them going forward if they're unable to push that buy online, pickup in store penetration, or curbside penetration higher as a percentage of digital sales. And actually, this is something that was referenced on the call by Cindy Davis, their chief brand officer. She said it was absolutely crucial for them going forward to begin to leverage more of those buy online, pick up in store options, more of those curbside options in order to cut down on shipping expense, which is really eating away at margins for those e-commerce sales, especially now that e-commerce sales account for nearly a third of their overall sales at Bed Bath & Beyond. Now, granted, that's during pandemic conditions, but still, if you look at that, a third of your sales coming through digital channels, most of that getting shipped out directly to the consumer, you're paying an arm and a leg right now for shipping costs. We know that shipping companies are charging more because of peak shipping rates. As such, the more they can get customers to go to those physical stores to pick up the order, the better it's going to be for Bed Bath & Beyond. Now, looking at a company which for the last 5 years had lost some of their liquidity, this was a quarter for Bed Bath & Beyond of stockpiling cash. Indeed, positive cash flow was over $750 million. This came up several times on the call. This is slightly deceptive, though, because it includes proceeds from their sale of personalizationmall.com that was finalized in early August. However, they were able to funnel some of this $750 million towards their debt, which was paid down by a significant amount in the quarter. As a result, the company on the call boasted liquidity of $2.2 billion at the end of the quarter, which is 2 times their current debt load. Certainly a positive sign to see cash flow going the right direction for Bed Bath & Beyond. Mark Tritton, the CEO, applauded the quarter as a testament to the potential behind their digital first, I put that in quotes, and Omni Always, also in quotes, transformation plans. Omni Always seems a little bit redundant. That's kind of the point of Omnichannel. But before we dive into the call itself, Bed Bath & Beyond noted that so far in September, they are seeing more of what they saw in the second quarter as a whole, meaning mid-single-digit increases in comps broken down in much the same way as it was in the second quarter, with digital sales being up around 90% and in-store sales, or those brick-and-mortar sales, being down 10-12% range. Now, as far as the details they gave on the call itself, beyond just those prepared remarks, they gave a bit more background on their workforce reduction plan, something we were looking ahead to, and it's something the company says will provide about $150 million in cost savings. Now, they plan on a good portion of this reduction in workforce being driven through the closure of individual stores. As Leighton is always fond of pointing out, Bed Bath & Beyond as a company holds several other store banners, including Bye Bye Baby and World Market, chief among them. In this case, the store closures that they're speaking of are expected to mostly touch the Bed Bath & Beyond brand, should reduce the store count there to about 750. They're looking to close around 200 stores here in the next few years. So 750 stores from over 1,000 a few years ago for Bed Bath & Beyond, certainly shrinking that brick-and-mortar footprint. And anytime you close 200 stores, that's going to cut your staffing pretty significantly. So they see a lot of their workforce reduction coming through this channel, although they did mention consolidating roles on the corporate side as well, which makes sense. If you don't have as many stores to service, it gives you a chance to maybe consolidate roles and cut some staff. This after a lot of the front office staff was already cut when Tritton took over, wanting to basically implement his own staff into certain roles and creating new roles in the C-suite. Now, they expect the store closures themselves, aside from the cost savings from workforce reduction, to provide an additional $100 million yearly boost in savings. Now, as far as product selection, which I mentioned we would get to, and the type of product moving off of shelves there, they feel as though their marketing campaigns have paid off in certain categories. In particular, recent ad campaigns have touted their brands as a key back-to-college source, which isn't surprising because Target, again where Mark Tritton came to Bed Bath & Beyond from, was long a dominant force in the back-to-college category and, of course, famous for being popular among college students. There's a reason there's so many small-format Target stores near college campuses. That said, sales of college-specific product for Bed Bath & Beyond saw a 21% spike from May 1st through September 8th, so looking even beyond the end of their second quarter. They had a three-pronged approach to attracting students back to Bed Bath & Beyond. One was enhancing the curation of their assortments, another, more competitive pricing and value propositions, something that a lot of people have argued Bed Bath & Beyond has needed to do for some time, and increased targeting through marketing being the third. This resulted in subcategory surges when you look at college student-specific products, kitchen electrics, kitchen housewares, and drinkware and flatware for college students, all up triple digits in terms of sales over last year. And they were also able to adjust their ad campaign to kind of a college-from-home message, as they called it. And they feel like, looking back, that played really well amongst this age group. Also, while discounting and coupons have been reduced, as we talked about, for most of their shoppers, they issued college students a college savings pass that offers them 20% off their purchases through September 30th. Now, this resulted in 500,000 students signing up, and 400,000 transactions used this discount at the time of the call. And in fact, basket size for those that used this discount was 14% larger than college transactions that did not use the discount, which we found interesting. It really encouraged this particular age group to stock up while they were shopping. An additional positive is that even though this discounting period has ended, it ended September 30th, their data shows that 32% of college students they surveyed noted that they still have shopping to do for back to school. So they said, hey, our internal metrics show that there's a lot of runway to go as far as these college students are concerned, and they're really excited about the assortment for the last 3 months of the year that they're bringing to these college students. Now, because of this newfound success among this age group, not only did margins get a benefit, but they saw a massive number of customers who are new to the company overall. Now, taken as a whole, they saw 2 million new online customers during the quarter. About 1.2 million of those had been brick-and-mortar customers of one of their brands in the past, but 800,000 were not. Now, what was unclear on the call is how many of these 800,000 have been or will be repeat customers. We know from, obviously, the college student data that they have. There's great potential for them to become repeat customers at Bed Bath & Beyond, but still kind of unsure if this is translated as yet to Bed Bath & Beyond, where the customers in theory would be shopping less frequently than, say, other retailers in the general merchandise or grocery space. But we have seen indications from other retailers, hardware retailers, home improvement retailers among them, as well as general merchandise and grocery retailers, as well as third-party data, that customers that have been picked up during the pandemic are more likely to become repeat customers. They're more likely to stick. So that's a positive for Bed Bath & Beyond as long as they can continue to attract those same customers back through their doors, or in this case, back to their website. Now, as much as we were looking forward to this call, kind of was a bit of a cliffhanger, because Tritton promised on the call that even more details about the company and the company's plans over the next 3 years would be announced during their investor day to take place towards the end of the month, October 28th, the scheduled day for their digital investor day. Of course, not in person this year because of the pandemic. So that look at Bed Bath & Beyond will wrap up our news segment for the day. Coming up, our interview with T. Jacob Schmoody, the produce manager at the Bisman Community Food Co-op, who talks about natural grocery as it pertains to single-location retail in a mid-sized market. And while it seems to be a kind of niche concept, some of the aspects he discusses are pretty pertinent to other areas of retail. Also, I think you'll find his product sourcing methods to be fairly interesting and kind of the processes that go through there. And he'll also talk about the operation overall of a retail co-op and what that means for the community of Bismarck. Talked on the show a few times recently about my trip through the Dakotas and Montana that took place in the beginning of September. During my travels, I happened across an awesome grocery store as I was walking through just south of downtown Bismarck, North Dakota. It turns out this store was actually the Bisman Community Food Co-op, and it was so awesome that in the 18 hours I was in Bismarck, I actually went there twice. Everything was merchandised so well. There were tons of local products, and I was super stoked to find fresh aronia in the produce section, which you can barely ever find fresh or frozen. Actually, I had some of that aronia in a smoothie this morning, but I knew we just had to talk to someone with the co-op about the concept and their work to bring fresh, healthy food to a market that was otherwise not highly served in Bismarck in the organic grocery space. So joining us today is T. Jacob Schmoody, the produce manager at the co-op who's been there nearly since the beginning. T. Jacob, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you taking the time while being in Bismarck to stop by and see us. That's great. Great story.
Well, it was a fantastic look on the outside of the store. We'll post a picture of that to our Instagram, but the inside of the store was phenomenal as well. You know, I introduced the co-op a little bit, but I was wondering if you could explain a little bit to our listeners who maybe haven't been, what the co-op is, what they would see if they walked into the store today, and then the overall goal of the co-op as a whole.
Yeah, certainly. Well, we're a member-owned cooperative here in Bismarck and Mandan. We now probably have over 3,500 families that have invested and owned the co-op here. And what we try to do, we want to strive to just being committed to providing healthy and well grocery experience for our community. We want to support our community agriculture. And we want to give the families here options year-round where they can come and get some local produce, where they can get gluten-free products, where they can get vegan, vegetarian options, and all around just healthy food options. So when you walk into the co-op, there's no question. You can walk out of here without checking the ingredients list on your items because you're going to feel safe. You're going to feel safe bringing this food home to your family. That was the underlying goal when this all started. It's just not only supporting our local economy and farmers, but having healthy options for our community.
And we'll talk about the membership structure here in a moment, but you mentioned supporting local farmers, supporting the local community. I think a lot of people who haven't been through North Dakota or been around the area just think, well, you know, farmland, corn, wheat, soybeans, whatever. But there is a rather large variety of locally grown and locally produced items there in that area. What are some of the different locally produced products that people could find at the store there?
Well, of course, it varies by the seasons here. In North Dakota, we don't have the longest growing season, as everybody's aware, but we have partnered with several ranchers in the area and several producers and even local chefs and local fast makers and things like that. Currently, right now, we've got, of course, an array of local produce. We've got grass-fed, grass-finished beef. We've got organic beef that's local. We've got organic bison that's local. We've got a lot of different products that are just made right here in our communities, from candles to bagels and other things that different members of our community produce. But, you know, mainly we pride ourselves on offering those local producer items. You know, it just boggles my mind that we can't go into a national grocery store and get local beef, you know, and especially in our area, we have a lot of beef farmers and just a lot of farmers in general. And that was one of the main goals of this thing, was to provide an outlet for these farmers year-round.
Now, as the produce manager, you're obviously on the ground level as far as sourcing many of these local products is concerned. You mentioned you've got a lot of local produce in store now or in the co-op now. How does the dialogue go when either you're reaching out to local farmers or the farmers are reaching out to you? How does that process work as far as you're concerned?
Well, it is quite a process. You know, right now I'm currently dealing with, I'd say 16 local producers on the produce side of things, and it does get to be a lot. There is an initial dialogue that takes place, just, you know, making sure they're set up with the tax ID number, other things that we can make sure our taxes are covered on that side of it. But then I sit down with them and just figure out what products do they have, what availability do they have, how much they want for the product, and, you know, roughly how much I'm thinking I'm going to be taking on a weekly or monthly basis, depending on what it is. But everybody that walks in the door that has a bin full of eggplants or a truck full of sweet corn, I'll talk to you. And I enjoy talking and having those conversations. That's the most fun part of the job, is getting to know the farmers. And we have some really good relationships with our farmers. And so it's a lot of fun. But, you know, sometimes I reach out to them, and sometimes they reach out to me. It can happen in either instance. So it's the most fun part of my job.
That's awesome. It sounds like a really personalized process there as far as dealing with local farmers, local producers. So one other question I have, obviously you're the produce manager there. When I was in Bismarck, the produce section was absolutely full. There were all of these local products there. And I got to thinking, you know, winter's a pretty long season in North Dakota, right? So yeah, during the summer, during the fall, it's going to be pretty full. What do you do as far as product management in the winter? Does the produce section compress a little bit? Do you have substitute goods there? What are some of the things you look at as far as the produce section is concerned, because you do source so much locally?
There are several of our local producers that since our inception in 2016 have ramped up their smaller hobby farms and are now putting in greenhouses. They're adding furnaces. And yes, we're having produce locally grown, you know, about 10 months out of the year here last year. So we're hoping, you know, even with some microgreens, it'll be all year long. So there are producers that are growing with us, and they're coming along the ride with this thing, and they're building their business because we're here, which is just phenomenal. And that's, the, you know, one of the key aspects we wanted to focus on in starting this thing is that we could support this local economy. So, yeah, it's fun to see them grow with us. And as we grow together, and people will walk into the store in November and say, holy smokes, there's local romaine lettuce. It's November, and we're in North Dakota. When they see the light bulb go off in their head, it's quite a moment. Really all I do is just take steps out regionally as the seasons change. I try to stay as close as far as the region as I can throughout the whole year. But number one, we want to make sure we're working with farmers that are doing things in a sound manner, good for the environment, not doing anything or putting anything in the food. We cover all our bases from where our product's coming from, even if it's coming from California. I want to make sure it's coming from a farmer in California that I could call if I needed to, or just check up on and make sure he's doing things the right way too. So, yeah, that is important. But, yeah, that's pretty awesome.
I want to go back to kind of the membership structure of the co-op. Now, as far as becoming a member is concerned, as far as membership is concerned, what's kind of the structure there, and what does membership provide to someone that would be in the Bismarck area?
Yeah, certainly. That's one of the most frequently asked questions, definitely, about becoming a member and what that actually entails. What we have structured is a one-time membership fee of $200, and that includes your entire household. So we're a little different than a lot of other co-ops that I've visited and chatted with. A lot of people will do like yearly subscription kind of things. But we are one-time deal, $200, and we can break that up into monthly payment plans too. We do, I believe, a four-quarter payment, $50 a quarter kind of thing here. So there's some options there, but, you know, definitely number one, what you're getting when you're becoming a member at the co-op is, you know, you're involved in making our community not only more aware, but just being part of a health and wellness movement and a local economy that, you know, a lot of people are proud to say they're a part of. And that's a big reason why I get up in the morning is that I am a part of this thing. And we are moving in a direction that's going to benefit our community and our families. So that's number one. You get certain deals and discounts when you're in the store shopping as a member. You don't have to be a member to shop at the co-op, but you do get a few items on a cheaper level than our community members. Also, you get to partake in our governance of the co-op as a member. You're a part owner, and you get to vote on different things that are occurring throughout the year at the co-op. You get to also run and be a part of the board if you'd like. We are voting here in about 2 weeks on our board. Our new board will take in effect in October. So, yeah, there's a few different benefits that you get. But number one, you get to be a part of this great movement.
So certainly that's a lot different structure than your average grocery store that's out there. And you mentioned, you know, the various community meetings and the board meetings and voting for the board and that type of thing. What are some of the structures around the meetings? What are some of the things that are discussed and topics that come up when you do meet?
Obviously, finances are a big one. You know, we have to maintain a profitable business, number one, to be able to keep coming here every day and turning lights on. So that basically becomes a lot of what we meet and have to deal with different cash flow, different product flow, those types of issues. But there's a lot of other issues that come up as far as personnel, as far as community. We have some different building things we've gone through for additions or add-ons and things like that. So it's the general meeting, keeping our doors open and offering the service to the community. And a lot of things come up throughout that process.
So we've talked quite a bit about, obviously, serving the community, being part of this movement. And I found when I was in the store that the store is as much about retail as it is about education. What are some of the outreach programs that you have both in-store and outside the retail presence there in Bismarck to continue to educate customers and your co-op members as well about the food?
Yeah, certainly. We have, and I don't know while you were here if you had a chance to see it, but kind of up on our second level here, we have some staff offices and things. We have what's called our community room, and we can seat roughly about 45 people in this space, and I'm actually standing in it right now. Got a wonderful flat screen monitor. We've actually got a cooking range and sinks up here. So we've done a lot of different cooking demos. We do how to make kimchi, how to make kombucha, how to sprout, all sorts of different programs or things for our community up here throughout the whole year. And you can certainly get in contact with us to get a schedule of those events. We also provide the space to the community for their different meetings and things that come up. It's a beautiful space. And so as a member, you do get a huge discount on using this room and space also. But we try to, we're also kind of in the middle of creating some media programming to kind of let the community know our involvement with the local producers. And so we're trying to really open the eyes of our community as far as having a grocery store that's focused on health and wellness and supporting local economy. And so that's really important to us. And those are types of programs that we get involved in throughout our community, and it's a lot of fun.
So we talk about some of these ongoing programs. You know, in looking at some of the things that the co-op has done during your time there, was there a particular campaign or initiative or maybe movement that you took part in where you were able to look back and say, that was awesome. I'm really proud about that. I'm really proud that we were able to do that for this community.
Oh, boy, there's... Looking back, me personally, because prior to handling and working with the produce here, I was also in charge of prepared food, deli, cafe. And so I got the opportunity to get involved with a group, and I won't name any names, but a senior citizen group. I was fortunate to be able to talk in front of a couple, several larger sized groups of our citizens, cook them some food, and talk about the co-op. And it was part of a senior living kind of health and wellness walk. They had a few different opportunities throughout the community to go to different events, and this, my events were one of those things. And so a real nice program to be a part of. I was very proud to help with that group. The people just really loved it, and I feel like they got something out of it. It was a lot of fun, definitely.
So in talking about all of this, obviously the last 6 months or so have been a very different time for all retailers. We've seen, obviously, pandemic buying ramp up. We've seen other ways in which retailers have been affected. What are some ways in which the co-op has had to adjust their approach, whether that be in, you know, maybe supply chain, some of that ready-to-eat food, and so forth?
Yeah, boy, we've had to make a lot of changes, just like a lot of businesses have. But I think where we stepped in most critically in our community has just been with a lot of the broken supply chains that have occurred, especially in food. People couldn't get chicken, couldn't get beef. We were able to step in as a co-op, and our shelves didn't run out. We called our farmers in the community. We got them to rally around us, and we provided that local beef option when none of the major grocery chains were getting any beef. So, you know, we stepped in a few instances like that. We never ran out of toilet paper. You know, we were kind of really excited when we were able to step into our community and do that, make those connections actually work and come alive during a time when everybody really needed it. It was impressive to see. It was really really cool to be a part of, and I learned so much, but not only myself, I think our community learned also, you know, where our food is sourced from. What would happen if some of that major sourcing stops, and they need to know there's other options, and that's why we're here.
That's fantastic that you were able to keep that supply chain moving with the local producers to make sure everyone in that area was served. I'm going to kind of finish on this because we've talked a lot about various different initiatives in the past, the overall scope of the co-op. What's next for the Bisman Community Food Co-op? What's next on the radar? What are some things that you want to focus on achieving here over the next year or two?
Well, I think bottom line is profitability is kind of in our scope right now. You know, we're going on year four here, and, you know, we've made a lot of mistakes, but we've learned a lot about the retail business. And so I think, number one, we're going to try to get profitable not only for our members, but for some of our loanees also. We want to let the community know that we're not only here long-term, but we're here, we're going to be profitable, and we're going to work with our community to keep these products moving. We've got a lot of different, you know, in-store kind of things we're working on. We're doing weekly newscasts, television broadcasts regarding food here at the co-op. We're cooking for them. We're demoing food. So we're really able to kind of highlight a lot of our products through that media outlet. We're on the radio a couple times a week talking about some of the local products that are coming in every week to us from our producers locally, which is really important, and I think a great outlet for the community. But, you know, number one, we're just sticking to our mission and our key guiding principles, and we're going to stay committed to health and wellness in our community, hands down, moving forward.
That's fantastic. Well, once again, T. Jacob Smoody, the produce manager at the Bisman Community Food Co-op, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, I really appreciated it. Anytime you're back in Bismarck, please give me a call, and we'll go out and visit a local farmer together or something.
That's fantastic.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we thank T. Jacob for joining us once again. If you want to check out the Bisman Food Co-op and you're nowhere near Bismarck, you can actually check out their website. They've got a lot of great pictures. We also posted pictures on Instagram, or we are posting pictures on Instagram of kind of what the place looks like, but it's bismanfoodcoop.coop. T. Jacob helps with a lot of their media and a lot of their video as well. There's some video on the website. You get an idea of kind of how the store is laid out. So again, I think it was a fantastic experience for me. If you go anywhere near Bismarck, North Dakota, and I know from our stats, we don't have a ton of North Dakota listeners. Most of our listeners are in some of the bigger metro areas in the U.S., but if you ever get a chance to go through, that is a must stop. It's one of the best retail experiences I've had in the last year. I highly recommend that. So as far as our looking ahead segment is concerned for this week, we had a lot to potentially look ahead to. We had Schnucks announcing the rollout of product scanning robots in 60% of their stores over the next year or so. So that's kind of interesting. Retail sales at United Natural Foods banners increasing 12.9% in the fourth quarter. That was kind of interesting, especially since sales at their own retail stores outpaced sales through their other wholesale channels. Maybe you get an idea of why they decided to put off sales of those retail stores, including Cub Foods. And that suggests that their banners internally held are doing pretty well compared to their competitors. No, instead of looking ahead to anything else, we're looking ahead to Walmart, which it seems like they have been in the news week after week. They're almost in an Amazon-type news cycle here, but they announced in a blog, Janie Whiteside actually announced this in a blog post this last week, that they are going to undergo an update to the exterior and interior in Walmart supercenters. They're looking to do this in about 200 locations in fiscal 2021, which is their current fiscal year, in case you're wondering, and about 1,000 stores by the end of fiscal 2022. To get an idea, they have about 3,500 supercenters in the U.S. compared to their overall store footprint of 5,300. And if you've been to a Walmart supercenter of late, you'll notice that there are a number of loss prevention characteristics that they have implemented, including gates at the entrances and the like. Those are obviously small updates, but here, if you look at the pictures in these blog posts and what they're looking to do, it doesn't even look like a Walmart. In fact, you can go to their website or their news website, check out these pictures. Updated signage, still the same fonts on the prices that they show in store, the same fonts they've been using for now a very long time, but the fonts on the wayfinding and the other signage in the store going to be completely different. They're bringing out their logo to be more prominent on the exterior of the supercenter, of course, building out grocery pickup, which they've been doing now for some time. But one of the other things is increasing the amount of self-checkout stations and contactless payment solutions. We've seen a lot of this in supercenters already. If you go into a supercenter, it's almost difficult to find a line with an actual cashier in it, but they're looking at expanding this even more so. And one of the interesting things that Whiteside said in the blog post, and by the way, Whiteside is the Executive Vice President and Chief Customer Experience Officer at Walmart US, but Whiteside said that basically in developing the store, they were inspired by airport wayfinding systems as a way to navigate large groups of people. They want to push people through the stores more efficiently and more quickly. They want it to be less about a typical retail experience where you might just be shopping and milling through the aisles. They realize that most of their customers want to get in and get out fairly quickly. And so they're implementing some new wayfinding systems and building it to where as much as possible is contactless. And I think this is interesting because what it is a reflection of the fact that obviously they were implementing scan and go technology and self-checkouts way before COVID hit. But what is most interesting to me is that they are doubling down on the strategy. They're saying, hey, our customers want this. They want to move through the store in a particular process. And I think this is fascinating because I kind of wonder, as far as the looking ahead portion of this story is concerned, not only are we looking ahead to these new designs popping up around us, but also we're looking ahead to the fact that this might be a pretty consistent thing as far as new store layouts are concerned. It'll be interesting to see in what ways the pandemic really pushes retailers to update some of those self-checkouts as far as retail is concerned. And you wonder how much this is going to trickle down to even the Dollar Generals of the world, who have a chance to really implement a lot more contactless technology than are already in stores. You think about a retailer in Dollar General that's opening up 1,000 stores a year. They might choose in the future, in the very near future at least, to install some things that might have been popularized during the pandemic. And also, to what extent has the pandemic shifted the customer expectation and focus towards using self-checkouts? You know, every time I go to a grocery store, even in today's day and age, if there are no standard checkouts open and someone has to use the self-checkout, oftentimes I will hear complaints about having to use the self-checkout. Those complaints seem to have gone down a little bit based on my conversations with retail employees and grocers and the like who are at least near me or in my travels. So I think that's very interesting too, because you have customer expectation changing. I remember when self-checkouts were implemented in Kmart in the late 90s, there was so much complaining about it because it was a thought by the customer, well, why would I do something that you would otherwise pay someone else to do? You know, shouldn't I be paid to do this work and this, that, and the other thing? And now it's almost an expectation there, being able to walk into a store, come in contact with as few associates as possible, and purchase a product, at least in the grocery and general merchandise space. So that's why I'm looking ahead to this, to see if this Walmart model, this airport wayfinding model, you think about an airport, you very rarely have any interaction with an associate in an airport. You wonder if that's going to be more of a thing in retail. Well, it's kind of interesting because looking ahead to next week's podcast, we're actually going to be talking with Ron Thurston. He's the author of a book called Retail Pride. It's scheduled to come out on October 13th. And Ron is going to talk about why the brick and mortar experience is still very pertinent to retail, why human-to-human interaction is so important, but more importantly, why retail employees should take more pride in their retail careers. It's a very fascinating book. We're going to talk to a lot of aspects in those books. And Ron is someone who just has this infectious love of retail. I think you'll find the interview rather interesting. That's coming up on next week's show. Well, once again, for Leighton Behind the Scenes, I'm Trent saying so long until next week. We'll be at you with another edition of the Retail Focus Podcast.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.